Okay, so this morning, what I want to do, we're kicking off this series. So this year, one of the things our Beit Midrash has been doing is what we've called, as you can see in the logo on the right-hand side, celebrating 70. Right? The State of Israel, it's celebrating its 70th birthday. And we wanted to celebrate along with it by taking the time to reflect on different aspects of Israel's history. I mean, one of the things we've had fun doing is looking through the history of Israel's chief rabbis, which has been a collection of some fascinating individuals. I'm not sure if any of them are quite as fascinating as the person we're going to talk about today, Rabbi Shlomo Goren. I gave you two pictures here. The picture on the right is just a picture of him in his army uniform. The picture on the left is the famous picture in 1967 when Israel reconquered the old city and made it to the Kotel, to the Western Wall. So Rav Goren insisted, right? People don't realize this. This was not an ad hoc picture. It wasn't something like he wasn't someone who happened to carry a shofar in his back pocket and happened to make it to the Kotel. He was very into symbolism. And planned this. And if you look carefully, you'll see that he doesn't actually have a helmet on his head because he was also fearless and didn't really care that there were bullets flying overhead. He just wasn't one of those people who cared. Rabbi Goren, as I gave you in the middle here, was an Orthodox religious Zionist in Israel, Talmudic scholar, foremost authority in Jewish law. He was the first chief rabbi of the IDF in 1948. And eventually became the third Ashkenazi chief rabbi from 1973 to 1983. After that, he established a yeshiva. He also served in several wars as in the army. Fascinating, fascinating personality. If you get the chance, if you want a really incredible book, I took it out of the Bathurst Clark Library. I'm sure you can get it in Toronto or Vaughan or wherever. His autobiography, which was translated as With Might and Strength, really an incredible work to read. A little bit more about his biography. So he's born in Europe to a Hasidish family, but of the Zionist sects of Hasidut. And his parents make Aliyah, move to Israel before the state. They move to the north. His father and their community were tasked with clearing the swamps. So as he said, the entire family spent years alternating who would have malaria. Right, they would just go around. A very fearless family. He was a child prodigy. He entered some of the most advanced yeshivot in Israel. At the age of 12, he entered Yeshivat Hebron at 12, where the average age was mid-20s to 30s, mastered the Talmud. If anyone's ever studied Talmud, you know it's a bit of a slow read. He was instructed by his teacher to learn to study seven double pages a day with the commentaries, which he started off doing and then switched to learn 24 a day. Photographic memory, also a fearless personality, insisted throughout his time of also being active in the military. And, you know, as we mentioned, becomes the first chief rabbi of the IDF because he was one of those personalities that combined rabbinic scholarship and military prowess, and eventually became the chief rabbi of the state in 1973. Now, what we're going to do today, because I know we call this series Chief Rabbis, Clergy, or Politicians, or something like that, is not just focus on Rav Goren himself, but I called the shiur Shlomo and David, Rabbi Shlomo Goren and David Ben Gurion, which is the title of an article at the end of the autobiography written by Dr. Tzvi Tzameret. And this isn't theoretical. One of the things that's fascinating to watch about Rav Goren is his relationship, his very, very good relationship with Ben-Gurion as they were forming the state. And we're going to analyze some of their interactions today. Okay. So what I want to do, though, is take you a bit through Rav Goren's personality, through his halachic decisions, through his life stories, and try to get a feel for who this person was. First thing you got to know about Rav Goren, and this is what makes him, one of the things that makes him fun to talk about, is that he loved symbolism. Right? Some people do things that are symbolic, don't even realize they're symbolic. But certain people really love symbolism, so they go out of their way to do cool things. Right? Things that will get you good pictures, like this, right? At the blowing the shofar at the Kotel in the Six-Day War. I gave you a number one, my summary, from Toronto Terra, from our weekly publication. But I think this story that I put here captures his symbolic, mystical personality. So here's the story. In 1956, a Jew visited Rav Goren and told him he had a dream. And so imagine the story. And what did he say? He was instructed to travel to Turkey to buy the horn of a specific type of ram to make a shofar. He was then to use this to make a large shofar for Rav Goren to blow on the top of Har Sinai, of Mount Sinai. This is what the person came and told him. He said, I had a dream that I'm supposed to make you this big shofar, this big horn for you to blow on Mount Sinai. Rav Goren insisted against the man's wishes to pay him handsomely for the shofar, right? So he actually shows up with this big, beautiful shofar, this big horn, big ram's horn. Considering the expense of traveling to Turkey to acquire the horn, at the time, this was a fantastic dream, as Israel had no control over the Sinai Desert. However, soon after this, Israel conquered the Sinai Desert during the Kadesh campaign. When Rav Goren heard, despite the fact that he had no authorization, right, this was illegal, right, what did he do? He knew he had this shofar, and there was a dream that he was supposed to go to Mount Sinai and blow the shofar. He traveled with his jeep to Jebel Musa, which is a mountain in the Sinai Desert, which many, including Rav Goren, believed is Mount Sinai. And he climbed the mountain. He records that he had to climb about 3,300 steps to reach the top of the mountain, a height of 2,285 meters in elevation. It was difficult, and he was crawling by the time he reached the top. However, he reached the top to blow the shofar and fulfill the dream. Right, so this is Rav Goren, right? He's a very mystical personality. He's very into symbols. And therefore, someone shows up at his door, right? Someone showed up at my door with a big ram's horn. I'd say, first of all, I don't know how to blow it. I don't have the lung capacity. Second of all, I'm not climbing into any mountain anywhere, right? I'm not, definitely not illegally, right? I'm not hopping in a jeep, going in the middle of the Sinai Desert, climbing up on top of a mountain, blowing a horn after crawling the last few hundred meters because I'm exhausted or dying of dehydration. It's not happening. But to Rav Goren, that was the most natural thing you could do. Similarly, in 1967, he decided to return. He decided he wanted to write a Sefer Torah on Mount Sinai, right? What could be more symbolic than writing a Torah on the mountain that he believed was where we received the Torah? So in 1967, again, illegally, he goes up the mountain, he wrote the first letters of a Sefer Torah, and then he returned there again to complete the scroll. And if you want to see the pictures, I gave you the link here. The IDF, even though at the time it was illegal, right, it's become a legendary story of Rav Goren. You can see all these wonderful pictures. And I wrote that both of these incidents are part of a pattern in Rav Goren's life, on taking symbolism seriously and performing acts that captured the biblical proportions of the event occurring in the life of the young state of Israel. But why is this important? It's not just important because Rav Goren is a fascinating human being, but because part of what drove him to do symbolic acts was that he felt, now why do we plant flags on the moon, right? Because we recognize it's one small step for, right? Right? Why do we remember these phrases, right? One small step for man, giant, what is giant leap forward for mankind, or whatever the exact phrase is. Why do we then do it and then plant an American flag on the moon? Because when we recognize we're in the middle of a historical process, we want to mark it. Because human beings, we respond to symbolism, right? We are moved by symbolism, right? You think about it at a wedding, right? We all, you're just waiting, right? It's Pavlovian, right? You hear the glass break, you say Mazel Tov. It doesn't matter if you're in a restaurant and someone drops a plate and it shatters, you say Mazel Tov. Right? It doesn't matter. We are so trained. There are certain moments in our life that are powerful, so we attach symbols to them, we respond to them. And if you want to make it clear, and you really feel that you're making history, then you mark it. And that's why the picture that I gave you here at the top left, when Israel reconquered the old city, right, Goren said, the first person to reach has to be the chief rabbi of the IDF. It has to be. It has to be me. And I have to bring a shofar, which is the symbolic Jewish horn. And I need to blow it. And I don't care if there are bullets whizzing over my head. I don't care, as you can see, as I said before, I'm not wearing a helmet. You will get me there. Right? Everyone else, right? He tells the stories that everyone else is cowering, their bullets flying, everyone's scared they're going to die. They're terrified for him. They say, right, Goren, you can't go. Right? It's dangerous enough for the paratroopers in all their gear. You're holding a Sefer Torah and a shofar that doesn't arm you well against bullets. And he says, I don't care, right? We're recapturing the Western Wall. I'm going to be there. We're going to blow the shofar. We're going to mark this. Now, it wasn't only Rigoren who was into symbolism. Ben-Gurion was also heavily invested in symbolism. And one of his pet projects, one of Ben-Gurion's projects in life, if you skip to 3 for a moment, was what's called in Hebrew, Ivrut. In English, the Hebraicization of names. I gave you the Wikipedia page. I don't have to read through all of it. I can summarize it outside, but in case you're interested in reading more, I gave it to you here. But what happened? During the first and second Aliyot, there was a feeling, especially amongst Ashkenazi Jews, Jews who came from Europe, where names had been imposed on the Jewish people, and often negative names, right? You know, when Jews were given last names, were given family names, often if you were poor and you couldn't pay the premium, so they would give you a derogatory last name. If you were of, middle class and you could pay the basic fees for a last name, they would give you a, you know, sort of a meaningless last name, which is why we have so many last names that relate to colors or to professions, right? Ones that are just sort of, parev. They're, neither here nor there. And a few wealthy Jews would manage to get distinguished names. But if you were poor and you were Jewish, right, and you couldn't pay the fees, so you got a insulting last name, which some of, the Jewish last names, you translate them, they're not exactly complimentary. So there was this feeling that we're coming to Israel. Our last names, good, bad, neutral, as it is, are symbolic of the fact that we were downtrodden. We were under the thumb of foreign powers. So Ben-Gurion said, it's time, if we're coming back to Israel, we're rebuilding a land, we're becoming a nation, we need to do something that marks that. And he said, you know we're going to do it? We're going to make Israeli names. Because our family names are our identity, right? It's how we associate with our members of our family. It's why it's why I go around Toronto and people say, oh, I know your wife's grandparents, right? I was at your in-law's wedding, right? Because they know, right? They know that my wife's grandparents are Shore, so they know my father-in-law and mother-in-law are Shore, and so they know whose wedding they were at, right? We associate with our family through last names. So Ben-Gurion himself was born Gruen, Green, and became Ben-Gurion. But he took it farther. Later on, he issued an order to the Israeli Defense Force soldiers. This is in 4 if you skip. This is the bolded part of number 4, where he wrote, it is desirable that every commanding officer, from squadron commander to chief of staff, should change his surname, whether German, English, Slavic, French, or foreign in general, to a Hebrew surname, in order to be a role model for his soldiers. The Israeli Defense Forces must be Hebrew in spirit, vision, and in all internal and external expressions. A binding order of the same issue was issued to the officials of the state in 1950. Right, it started as a suggestion. By 1950, it was law that diplomats who represented Israel abroad had to take on an Israeli name. They had to shed their diaspora last name, they had to take on an Israeli name. A committee for Hebrew names was established to supervise the implementation of the order, whose task was to assist and advise the choice of a Hebrew name. Now, there were some who opposed this. Right? There were some who opposed this. If you skip to 6, I gave you a quote from Moses Calvary in his book, Between Sowing and Harvest, where he wrote as follows. Our names are a significant part of our history. Bearers of historical names are still alive and among us. The names of figures who mark our history, names like Sesportis or Benavisti, Abarbanel or Don Yechia, Rappaport or Eibschitz. There's no reason to delete the chronicle of our national life. Let us preserve the faith of our fathers also in our revival. Do not betray our memories by radical action. And the text does not only relate to the famous, the variety of our names is a sign of our colorful history, a 2,000-year-old history whose traces cannot be wiped out light-handedly. Right? So there were some who said, you can't do it. Right? Just because we're building a new state doesn't mean we wipe away our past. We bring our past into the future. But this was not Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion said, no, that's not right. That's not how the world works. We're starting a new era. We're turning over a new page. We need to do something symbolic to mark that. Now let's return to Rav Goren. How did Rav Goren become the chief rabbi of the IDF? So, 1947, he's functioning as the de facto rabbi of the pre-state forces. As the state is coming to an existence, the chief rabbis at the time, Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi Herzog and Rav Benzion Meir Chai Uziel, suggest that he should become the official chief rabbi of the army, and they send him with a letter to that effect to Ben-Gurion. And he hits it off with Ben-Gurion. They got along very well. I put a link here later, I believe. Yes, I did. Later on, I put a link. You can see if your Hebrew is good, that there are subtitles to a ceremony honoring Rav Goren towards the end of his life, where Ben-Gurion was present, and the two of them are reminiscing about these moments. You can actually see them talk about it if you're interested. It's a fascinating clip. But they have a great meeting, and Ben-Gurion takes the advice of the chief rabbis to appoint Rav Goren as the chief rabbi of the army. But, Rav Goren continues, when I came into the meeting, my name was not Shlomo Goren, I was born Shlomo Goronchik. And as I left the meeting, the last thing he said, I was on my way out the door, and Ben-Gurion turns to me and he says, what is this chick? Drop the chick. And he said, I went in Goronchik, and I left Goren. Right? And that's how Rav Goren came into existence. But I think it's not an accident. Right? I don't think that the only reason that Rav Goren dropped the chick, right, was because it was very hard to say no to Ben-Gurion. But I think it was because, as we already saw in the stories, changing names to mark a new era comes from a sensibility, a mystical sensibility, that symbols are important. Ben-Gurion had that intuition on the political side, but Rav Goren's life represented that on the religious side. And therefore, when Ben-Gurion told Rav Goren, you know, drop the chick, make your name sound more Israeli, I think it resonated with him. And why would it resonate with him? Why specifically the names? So if you go back to 2, it's not only Ben-Gurion who had this intuition that names are particularly important when defining our identity. The Midrash in Vayikra Rabbah says as follows. Rabbi Yehuna stated the name of Bar Kappara. Israel were redeemed from Egypt on account of 4 things. Right? The rabbis of the Midrash want to know, in what merit did the Jews leave Egypt? Right, they didn't have the Torah. They didn't keep God's commands. So why did God want to redeem them? What did they do to deserve it? So the Midrash tells you several things. The first of which is because they did not change their names. They did not change their language. They did not go tail-bearing. And none of them were found to have been immoral. They did not change their name, having gone down as Reuven and Shimon as Reuben and Simeon, and having come up as Reuben and Simeon. They did not call Reuben Rufus, nor Judah Leon, nor Joseph Lestis, nor Benjamin Alexander. And the Midrash says that why do the Jews deserve to go out as Jews, as the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rivka, Rebecca, Rachel, Leah? Why did they deserve that? Wait, what did they do that made them Jewish? So the Midrash says, among other things, they kept their names. They may not have, it may have been minimal, right? As we know from later prophets, they were idol worshippers in Egypt. But despite that, there was something Jewish about them. They clung to their identity. Now, this traditionally means first names. But there were rabbinic thinkers, and I think the Rav Goren never articulated this position. Later rabbis did, and you skip, for example, to number 8. Rav Shlomo Aviner is a current leading rabbi in the religious Zionist community. He was not born Shlomo Aviner, which is about as Israeli Jewish sounding as you can get. He was born with a name that's a little bit less Jewish sounding. He was born Claude Langenauer, which, yeah, that sounds a little bit less Jewish. He was born in France. At some point, he came to Israel and changed his name to Shlomo Aviner. And he says why. So he was asked the question. He said, regarding Hebraicizing a family name, is it something that's merely permitted, or is it a proper, needed, and important as part of the return to Israel and the separation from the exile and the like? Should this be done, even if the other brothers will not change their family name? And is permitted to do this if the parents oppose? So his answer was, there is benefit to Hebraicizing a name so that we'll have Jewish names. There is certainly a value to a Jewish name and not a non-Jewish name. It's not a commandment or obligation, but it's a righteous trait which is pushed aside for something different. However, that which the other brothers are not changing their name, that makes no difference. He said, look, it is valuable. And then he goes on to quote the sources that I put before, the Midrash, about the Jews changing, not changing their Jewish names, and other sources as well. But the first thing that I think is to say about Rav Goren is that one of the things that drove his life was this conviction that Israel, that the Jewish people were entering a new era, and that requires marking it with symbols. And therefore, he saw eye to eye, and this was the beginning of his fruitful relationship with Ben-Gurion, because Ben-Gurion as well thought, if we want to really enter a new era, then we need to act like we're in a new era. Hence the drop the chick. Sure, I'll drop the chick. I'll become Rav Goren. Hence, Rav Goren saying, I will go up to Mount Sinai and blow the shofar because someone had a dream. Right? The Jewish people have a dream of coming back to the state of Israel, but individuals have dreams, and I will mark it and I'll respect it and I will risk my life. Once, I'll go up a second time and write a Torah. I'll go up a third time. I will walk through the old city while bullets are flying to blow that shofar because symbols mean something. I gave you in 7 just because I had to, from my late teacher, Rabbi Yehuda Amital. Rabbi Yehuda Amital was the founding Rosh Yeshiva of my alma mater, of Yeshivat Har Tzion, located in Alon Shvut. Also, not born Amital, he was born Yehuda Klein. When he moved to Israel, he changed his name to Amital, and he was asked, he said, after the Holocaust, you changed your name from Klein to Amital. What was behind that decision? So he said, my name was Klein. In Hungary, it was a very common Jewish name. It doesn't mean anything. I mean, it does mean small. But he said, now my name has more meaning. There's a verse that says, the remnant of Yaakov shall be in the midst of many peoples like dew from the Lord, like showers upon the grass, that hopes not in man and waits not for the sons of men. I felt that this verse described our situation during the War of Independence. We were alone. We fought almost alone against the whole world. I looked for a name. I shall be like dew for Israel. And he said, I want a name, Amital, my nation is like dew. Which he took from the prophets because he said, I went through the Holocaust. I came to Israel. We're starting a new era. The freshness, right? What the verses are drawing, that freshness, you wake up in your cottage, right, in camp, On a beautiful summer morning, the mountain air, the mountain dew, there's that freshness. It feels like you've entered something new. It's just exhilarating. And Rav Amital said that's how he felt the Jewish people were when he came to Israel. So he changed his name from Klein to Amital. And Rav Goren and Ben Gurion felt the same way. You needed to express things in symbols. So that's the first thing about Rav Goren's life that I want to that we've explored. The second one, Rav Goren and Ben Gurion shared another commitment. A commitment to unity between secular and religious Jews. But to illustrate the way they express this, I have to tell you another story. This is the story of the two cooks. This is a hard story to hear, but we'll tell it nonetheless. I summarized it for you in 9. And it appears, again, in the autobiography. So here's the story. July 31st, 1948. There are two cooks in the army, and they refuse to cook on Shabbat. Their officer is not religious, is anti-religious. He's not happy with them. He convicts them for insubordination. But then, and he sends them to military prison for a week. But then he does something quite vindictive. And right after the Holocaust, particularly symbolic, he shaves their head, including their peyot, right? Which is what the Nazis often did, right? Just to humiliate the religious Jews. So this officer was so anti-religious, and he was so angry at these two cooks, that he shaved their heads. The cooks appeal their sentence, and in yet a further act of vindictive rage, they extend their sentence to 3 months. At this point, a firestorm begins in Israel. Rabbi Maimon, who is the religious affairs minister, resigns. And he says, such an army does not deserve to be a Jewish army. I am out. There are protests in Bnei Brak, Ramat Gan, Tel Aviv. Religious Jews are in an uproar. The state has just started. It's about to crumble under an internal civil war. Ben Gurion says, we've got to stop this. So he instructs Staff Major General Yaakov Dori to issue a public statement saying, we will create a military rabbinate, and the military rabbinate will deal with these questions. Okay. So, calm is restored. Country is convinced that steps will be taken to make sure this never happens again. But, how is it not going to happen? So, there's a meeting of the cabinet, of high officials in the army. And they sit there and they say, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to prevent the next conflagration, the next explosion between religious and non-religious Jews? What are we going to do? So if I asked you, what would you do? Right? What would you do at that moment? What's your suggestion? Right? You're a cabinet member now. Right? You've got to respond to this previous horrible incident. You've got to plan for the future. What would you do? Right, so they have the committee. You're on the committee. Now what do you do? It's up to you. Make the suggestion on the committee. What do you do?
Listen to both sides.
And then do what? Listen to both sides and?
Compromise.
What decision? So one possibility is compromise. What's another possibility?
Have your right and your right.
Yeah, so how would you do your right and your right? What would that look like? Yeah, but how would you do it? Right?
Separate
the units. Right? Say you're right. So there'll be religious units, there'll be non-religious units. So Rav Goren says, he recollects, he said, I got to the meeting. There were two opinions. Everybody versus me and Ben Gurion. The religious, for the first time in Israel's history, maybe the last, all the religious cabinet members and all the secular ones and all the anti-religious ones agreed. They agreed, let's go our separate ways. And they were quite expressive. I gave you these wonderful quotes. Secular, Aaron Sisling of Mapam. Here was his quote, or Rav Goren's recollection of it. He was ready to put all the religious soldiers in separate companies, platoons, battalions, and divisions, to give them everything they wanted. Let them pray all day, every day, all week long. Let them eat chulent all week long. Do whatever they wanted on the condition that they let the non-religious soldiers do whatever they wanted. Right? The secular got up and said, look, I don't care what you do. Right? I don't care. Right? Daven, pray all day, keep Shabbat 7 days a week, eat chulin for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I don't care, right? Gefilte fish, whatever you want, right? Whatever you want. Just leave us alone, right? Leave us alone to violate Shabbat, to have our ham for breakfast. I don't care, right? Just leave us alone. You leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. Everyone will be happy. The religious parties said, that's a great idea. And they all said, issue a military order obligating the army to assign religious soldiers to religious units so they could maintain the lifestyle in which they were raised, could observe Shabbat, the holidays, kashrut, and everything else. So there was total agreement. The secular and the religious cabinet members said, let's just go our separate ways. You do what you want, we do what we want, I don't care. Just perfect! What's the problem? But then we're not a unified country. Right, what type of country is this? Right, Gorin gets up there, and I gave it to you in bold. He yells at the religious ministers, and he said, what would the ramifications be of the religious soldiers being segregated in religious units? The result would be that the entire army wouldn't observe religious precepts, wouldn't eat kosher food, wouldn't observe Shabbat and holidays, wouldn't have any synagogues. Only the few special units would be defined as religious, have strictly kosher food, observe all the Shabbat laws, and have synagogues. Now that we had the right to establish our own state, now that we built the IDF, we had the right to demand that the entire army behave like a Jewish army. Right? Gorin said, what are you doing? We just won the right to a state. Religious or not, a certain level of our traditions are part of being the Jewish people. You're going to give up on everything? You're just going to say, let the secular Jews do whatever they want, right? Cut themselves off from history, cut themselves off from the tradition, so that you are free to, you know, daven in peace and have your Shabbat meals? Are you out of your minds?
But then who decides?
So, hold that thought. The question of who decides, hold that thought, because that's going to be important. Now, Rav Gorin adds, right, it's not just that there'll be no religious identity. He says, furthermore, I gave this to you in 11. This is in the YouTube clip. He says, beyond that, you can't have two armies. Right? It's not just that the state needs, in his view, a halachic component to it, but also you can't have two armies. And he says very pragmatically, you don't divide an army based on religious outlook. You divide it based on military skill. Right? Someone becomes a paratrooper because they're able to be a paratrooper. Right? They don't have fear of heights. I don't know. Right? They become they enter tanks because they can fit into a tank. They can work under that pressure. They go into intelligence because they have a high IQ, because they're good with computers. Right? It doesn't matter whether you keep Shabbat, don't keep Shabbat, keep kashrut, don't keep kashrut, what standards you keep of kashrut. What does that have to do with it? And therefore, Gorin said, he yelled at everyone. He said, what are you doing? We have a Jewish state. First of all, it's got to be unified. And second of all, we've got to add a little bit of Jewishness to the state. But if we're going to do that, you've got to give. So it'll be less comfortable for you. Ben-Gurion came in, and Ben-Gurion said, to quote in Hebrew first, he says, Yesh lanu am echad, tzava echad, medina echad, we have one nation, one army, one state. We cannot split the army based on outlook. And as Rav Gorin records it, Ben-Gurion's word was law. It doesn't matter what happened. And that was it. And that was it. It was done. But now we have the next problem. Diana's right. We have the next problem, which is, okay, that's great. Unity. Jewish identity to the army, to the arms of the state. Great. Now what do you do? Because you haven't solved the bigger problem, which is they really are. It's not a religious state. It's not a halachic state. So what are you going to do? So the answer is both sides have got to give. Right? If you really believe that the state has to be unified, and religious and secular Jews have to live comfortably, then you've both got to give. So they both did. Ben-Gurion gave up a lot. Ben-Gurion, who this drove his life, in 1947 had reached what became known as the status quo arrangement, right? And wrote a well-known, let's say, depending on who you ask, either famous or infamous letter, known as the status quo letter, in which he made a deal with the leaders of the Haredi community of Agudat Yisrael, who were anti-Zionist. And he said to them, look, if we're going to build a state, I get it, you don't want a state, you don't believe in Zionism, but it's going to be a reality. We can't have it that we're going to apply at the UN, we're going to argue for statehood, and you're going to come and oppose us. It just can't happen. We're not going to succeed that way. So, in return for your silence and your tacit approval, right? Not explicit, I don't expect you to change your views, I don't care, I'm willing to give up a lot. And here's what I'm going to give up for you. I'm going to give you educational autonomy. There'll be availability of kosher food in all government kitchens. We won't coerce people to eat it, but there'll always be kosher food available. And then the two biggest ones. Shabbat will be the national day of rest, and transportation won't run. Right? There'll be a Jewish character, a Sabbath character to the state, which 70 years later, we're still fighting about this. We're still fighting about this. And then, in perhaps the most controversial one, he said, and I will maintain what was true under the British mandate, which itself was a holdover from the Ottoman period, marriage and divorce will be under the auspices of the rabbinate. And if you read Israeli news or American news or any news, you know that this continues to be the source of perhaps the most tension of anything else in Israel. But why would Ben-Gurion, who was not religious, in many ways was anti-religious, who had abandoned halachic tradition and had grown up that way and actively moved away from it, why would he turn to the Aguda and say, here's what I'm willing to offer? And the answer is because he felt that, like it or not, we're in this together. Like it or not, Zionist or anti-Zionist, the state is the state for the Jewish people. And we're all going to have to do things that are hard for us, because unity is important. And therefore, you're anti-Zionist, you think that God doesn't want us to have a state, you think that it's the work of the Satan, I don't know what you think, right? Different views that were being espoused at the time. Fine, keep it to yourself, because this is going to be a reality. Don't hurt the rest of us. Right, be part of this state that you don't see eye to eye with. That's fine. And in return, I'll make hard concessions. You know, it struck me, this sentiment struck me quite. I was reading a few years ago, there was an attempt to come up with a solution to the continuing religious secular tensions in Israel. So one attempt was what became known as the Gavison-Maidan Covenant, or the Maidan-Gavison Covenant, which was a 100-page document or so, which was drafted by one of my Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Yaakov Maidan, and the secular professor, Ruth Gavison. And they go through suggestions of how we can fix the tensions, right? We can ease the tensions in Israel. And at one point, they make the following suggestion. That to ease the status issues, right, the marriage and divorce issues in Israel, control over marriage should be taken away from the rabbinate, right? Civil marriage should be instituted, but divorce should remain under the auspices of the rabbinate. Now, why was that compromise made, right? Well, right, I don't want to get into good idea, bad idea, but why was it made? So Ruth Gavison, who's the secular professor who was part of this, says as follows. She said, look, on the one hand, I'm secular, and I'm opposed to religious coercion, and I don't want the rabbinate in charge of anything. But on the other hand, I believe in unity, and I believe in not just, avoiding coercion, but avoiding coercion for my children. And she said, I know that for the religious community, marriage is important. But what's the worst that happened if civil marriage is instituted? So people who don't want to get married with a rabbi, don't want a chuppah, so they won't get married with a chuppah. So they'll, from a halachic perspective, they won't be married. Big deal. In halacha, if you live together without being married, it is not a good idea, it's prohibited, but what's the worst that'll happen? Right? The children are not mamzerim, right? They're allowed, they're not illegitimate, they're allowed to marry whoever they want. Right? There is no halachic stigma to a child born out of wedlock. Right? That status doesn't, there's no status like that. But what happens if divorce is taken away from the rabbinate? So suddenly what's going to happen? You'll have somebody who gets married with a chuppah, whatever, because they're traditional and they want to, because their parents are traditional and their parents want it, so they'll be married from a halachic perspective. But then they're going to get divorced, and at that point, right, there's no emotion, there's no sentiment in the divorce. They're not going to go to the rabbinical court. They're just going to go to a civil court. And from a halachic perspective, the woman then goes and remarries. That's considered adultery. The children are mamzerim. The children can't marry another Jew. She said, look, the cost to unity, if we create mamzerim, is that if my children decide to become religious, which she said, look, I'm not religious, but I believe in freedom, including my children's freedom to follow a different path than me. But what happens? They're going to want to marry into the religious community, and they won't be able to because of a decision I made. And she says, look, this is really hard for me to give up. I don't want to give up divorce to the rabbinate, but I'm willing to make the concession because I care about unity and I care about my children's freedom and their choice to go away from my path and become religious. So I'm willing to take this. I'm willing to do it. I'm willing to give up something that's so hard for me to give up and give up my autonomy. But that was Ben-Gurion. Right? Ben-Gurion said, I'm against religion, you know, I'm anti, right, religious. I don't want religious coercion. But I get it. Marriage is sensitive. If I don't give this to religious community, they're not going to be in on this. And he said, I'm willing to do it. Now, why does he get along so well with Rav Goren? Because Rav Goren felt the same way. Right? Rav Goren said, it is critical that the state managed to survive unified. But I've explained from a political perspective what you have to give up. What do you give up as a posek? What do you give up as a rabbinic authority? What are you going to give up? So if you look at the video, if you watch the video that I gave you, they asked Ben-Gurion, what did you admire so much about Rav Goren, about Ray Goren? And so he said different things. But he said, one of the things I admired so much about him was that he was one of the few rabbis who recognized that halacha couldn't always function in the modern state. Now, what he meant was that, or what it meant to Rav Goren, was that Rav Goren recognized that there isn't always one answer in halacha. It's very easy to say, look, we're religious, we want to hold to the highest standards possible, make sure we're not making a mistake. But if you're always going to go for the most stringent opinion to cover all your bases, this is never going to work. The only way to make halacha work for a broad population to face the challenges of the modern state is to be daring and creative. And therefore in 17, if you look at, skip to 17, Ray Goren in 1966 in a public lecture with Ben-Gurion and Dr. Nachum Goldman said as follows. This is a transcription. He said, it's clear that we need Torah leaders who will have a nationalistic approach to political questions and a positive approach to the historical turn of the Jewish people that happened with the establishment of the state. The eternity of the Torah lies in the space for maneuvering and the possibilities open to its guardians, scholars, and those who fulfill it. There's an expression in the Talmud Yerushalmi. If the Torah had been given clear cut, it would not have a leg to stand on. So the Torah could be expounded in 49 ways to render something impure and 49 ways to render it pure. In other words, if the Torah were given as a fixed code, do this and don't do that, it would not have been possible to stand on our feet and live according to it. Rather, it was given in a flexible way, with 49 ways to render something impure and 49 ways to render it pure, 49 ways to obligate it and 49 ways to exonerate. Each generation has its own innovations in Torah, but all of this is only within the framework of the Torah, within the framework of Halacha. And Rabbi Gorin said, and this is what Ben-Gurion saw in him, was that this really was going to be a compromise. That Rabbi Gorin wasn't going to say, look, I want a unified state, I want the state to work, and then say, give up everything to me. He said, look, there are certain things I can't give up. I can't give up my belief in Halacha. I can't do that. But I recognize if it's going to work, I need to be flexible. I need to understand that Halacha itself is dynamic. And I've got to put in my creativity and make it work as much as possible. And therefore, Gorin devoted his life to exploring the flexibility, exploring how much Halacha could bend with integrity from his perspective to make it work. And therefore, he said, look, how coming back to our army case, kosher food, that's pretty easy. Right? That's pretty easy. So the army will only serve kosher food. That's relatively easy. What about Shabbat? What are you going to do on Shabbat? So he said, look, so we won't coerce people to keep Shabbat. But the official stance of the army will be that no one can be forced to violate Shabbat unless it's something that is defined as pikuach nefesh, as a life-saving thing. If it's life-saving, halacha already builds in, you're allowed to violate Shabbat. But non-essential maneuvers won't happen on Shabbat. What's defined as a non-essential maneuver? So Rabbi Gorin spent his life expanding leniencies because it's not always so clear. Right? There are a lot of things that if I asked as an individual, we'd say that's not called life-saving. But if you ask a nation, it is. Right. So, for example, right, this came up in the context of police forces. An individual, if you ask, can I, you know, violate the Shabbat to, I don't know, to have a night watch on my house, right? I don't, because I'm worried that maybe someone will break in, right? So can I spend the night, you know, out there with my gun, do it, you know, to make sure no one breaks in my house, you know, doing whatever it is I need to do, stand on guard? The answer would be no. Like, why do you think someone's breaking into your house? You live in Toronto, right? How often does it happen, right? Like, you know, but if you ask a nation, right, if you ask it nationally now, if we said police have to shut down on Shabbat, will that create dangerous situations in the country if every murderer and, you know, thief knows that, right, 25 hours, right, a week, the police just shut down? The answer is obviously yes. So Rabbi Gorin introduces a principle of communal pikuach nefesh, that when we're dealing with a community, we define life-saving in a different way. Or to give another example, right, and I gave it to you in 15. But let me explain it outside first. Here is the question. Medical schools in Israel. Can you have medical schools in Israel? What's the problem? You need to do autopsies. You need to do dissections of human bodies, of cadavers. That's usually not permitted because you need to bury bodies, right? We have an obligation to bury the dead. We know that, right? It's one of our most sacred laws. But if you say that you can't use any bodies for dissection, so what are you going to do? So there were rabbis who said, find non-Jewish bodies, right? Which is a questionable assumption, may or may not work, depends on different things. I don't want to get into that right now. But Rabbi Gorin didn't go that way. Rabbi Gorin said, look, it's a bit complicated, so let me explain it outside. When the question was first asked to Rabbi Chezkel Landon in the 18th century, are you allowed to give up on the commandment to bury bodies in order to perform medical dissections, with the argument being that medical research in the long term leads to saving lives, Rabbi Landa said no. Why not? Because he says, look, it might be true that down the line, in the conglomerate, right, if you take everything together, so if you take everybody and don't bury it, instead, you know, bring it to a medical school, so sure, we'll advance the medical profession. But halacha doesn't look at things that way. And he introduced a term called chola lefaneinu. We only allow waiving biblical obligations when there's a proximate, right? There's a immediate result. Meaning, you have two people who are dying of the same illness, which you don't know what it is. One of them dies, and the other one is about to die. And the doctors say, if we perform an autopsy on the one who died, we might save the life of the second one. So then the Noda Behuda says, Rechezkalanda says, that you can do. But to say, I'm going to take a cadaver from someone who just died, you know, she just died, right? She just died, and we want to take the body so that we better know what it looks like inside a lung. Because maybe if we understand the lung better, down the road we'll be able to, etc., etc., etc. Landa said, look, halacha doesn't work that way. Rai Gorin said, that was very nice. Rabbi Cheska Landa living in Prague, first in Yampol, then in Prague in the 18th century, because he could say that, but medicine would still advance. Because say what he may, okay, right? Someone else is going to be a doctor. The medical profession will continue. Right? They were a minority population, so they'll go to the non-Jewish doctor. Big deal, right? Or the Jewish doctor will learn in the medical school from the teachers who did the dissections, or you know, whatever. But medicine will advance. But Rai Gorin said, "What's going to happen in Israel? What's going to happen if we say in Israel we don't do any dissections? So there can't be any medical schools." I mean, nowadays you could, because now we're moving away from dissections, because with technology we can recreate dissections virtually. That's better for everybody. Fine. But this wasn't true in the 50s. So Rai Gorin said, imagine the catastrophe. As it is, Israel has a problem in 2018, that it's a small country, so if you want to be a GP, so you can stay in Israel and go to medical school, you want to be a specialist in fertility, right? You've got to go somewhere else. So for a long time, the head of the department in Montreal, right, was an Israeli who had come to train under my wife's uncle in Ottawa, right? And he had become, right, like 3 years ago, he got called back to Israel to head up the department in Shaarei Tzedek. But for many years, he ended up here. Why? He wanted to be a specialist. Israel isn't big enough. It doesn't have specialties. So they go abroad. When they're abroad, they get offered a good job and they stay. But Rai Gorin said, imagine you do that to the millionth degree, right? You say we can't have medical school, so anyone who wants to be a doctor has to spend a few years abroad, right? By that point, what's going to happen? They're staying there, right? How many doctors are going to go train abroad and come back? And he said, when you're dealing with a nation, what's called saving lives is totally different. And therefore, he said, it's allowed. You can do dissections on cadavers, on Jewish cadavers, because when you view the country through a national lens, right, everything changes. And you see that what is Rav Gorin putting into this? Rav Gorin is saying, look, I need this country to work. I need it to work without relying on the non-religious Jews who don't care about halacha anyways. Right? Because Rav Gorin could have said, look, there's so many doctors who don't care, right? You know what? Let me just issue an order and say there won't be religious doctors, and anyone who doesn't care about halacha, so they'll do whatever they want, and they'll be doctors. But Rav Gorin said, that's not how I work. My job is to say, we're building a Jewish state together. My job is to say, if we decide to stay unified, and every member of society, regardless of whether they keep halacha or not, is going to commit to being part of society, in the army, in the police forces, in the as doctors, as medical professionals of all sorts, as lawyers, as businessmen, as farmers. If I want us all to work together, then I, as a poseg, need to come up for a way to explain how that's possible. And I'm going to do it. And that's why Rav Gorin, and here we have two principles, right, that drove Rav Gorin's life. One is his striving for unity, and two is his conviction that even if we all kept the Torah, even if we were all religious, the state could still survive. God, in his infinite wisdom, had put enough flexibility into the halachic system that it could work in modernity. And therefore, he got along with Ben-Gurion because he said, Ben-Gurion, you do your side, right? You make your political concessions, and I will make sure. Then the rabbinic side, right? I make it possible too. I'll think creatively with you. I'll work in ways that maybe are less comfortable. Of course, it would be more comfortable for the religious soldier to just say, I'm taking off on Shabbat. Goodbye, I'm going home for a Shabbat meal. I'll come back on Sunday and you do whatever you want. Even with all the Shabbat policies in effect, still, it's so much nicer just to go to shul, to light candles with your family, to be home. Right? It's still a sacrifice to say, no, you've got to be there. Right? Because by saying the army will keep Shabbat, what you're also saying is you'd better stay. Right? You don't get a buy for 25 hours. So far what we've seen in Rav Goren's life and in his interactions with Ben Gurion is that one, they both believed that as recognizing the historic significance of the State of Israel meant marking it with symbols, with names, with shofar blowings, with the writing of Sefer Torahs, marking history. Two, recognizing that if we're building a state together, we've got to make concessions, whether that mean political or even religious concessions. Three, a conviction that in order for that to work, you had to be flexible, even within the confines of halacha. And as Ben Gurion said, I could work with Rav Goren because he's one of the few rabbis who recognized that halacha couldn't function, at least the way it always had. And Rav Goren says, yes, that's exactly it. I worked together with Ben Gurion because I recognized the value of what he was doing, and I was willing to come up with the halachic language that would make it possible. And I didn't put it here, but in what became the most famous or infamous moment in Rav Goren's career, the Langer affair, right? This came out very, very clearly. Right? The Langer affair, there were two children who most rabbinic authorities thought were mamzerim, because their mother had remarried without getting a halachic divorce. Rav Goren, and that led to a crisis. It almost led to the destruction of the chief rabbinate, stripping them of their powers, a crisis in religious secular affairs. The coalition almost fell apart until Rav Goren, who was chief rabbi of Tel Aviv at the time, said, I think it's permitted. And then that led to machinations that led to him becoming chief rabbi. Now, there were many rabbis at the time that looked at this cynically and said Rav Goren only issued a lenient ruling because he wanted to be chief rabbi. But if you follow his life and the trajectory of his life, I don't think that's true. Meaning, you can argue or agree with his halachic reasoning in that case, but it clearly is an expression of everything believed in. Right? Rav Goren said part of his life was going to be dedicated to mining the halachic system for leniencies, even on unpopular ones, to make sure that the state could continue. And the Langer affair and the strict position espoused by many of the rabbinic authorities led to a crisis that almost made the possibility of religious Jews functioning with non-religious Jews in the state collapse, right? To destroying any vestige of halacha in the state, stripping the chief rabbinate of its existence, really. And Rav Goren said, I can't let that happen. But I think that it's legitimate for me to look for leniency with integrity to make it possible. Now, you can argue that he was blinded. He was so convinced that it needed to happen that he issued a psak that was wrong. He issued a wrong halacha. Or you could say that he was right. It doesn't matter. But the point is that he was driven in that moment by those same convictions that made him work so well with Ben-Gurion, that allowed him to be the first chief rabbi of the army, to create policies that to this day allow religious and non-religious Jews to function together, that allowed him to become the chief rabbi, that allowed him to have a fruitful relationship with Ben-Gurion and create a halachic, a Torah flavor to the state without being too coercive. And yeah, recalibrating it continues to be hard, right? And we see how hard it is, and there's constant eruptions. But as disheartening as it is to sometimes see the eruptions, you have to remember, the reason they're there is because we chose 70 years ago to work together. And if we decide to not split, we decide to continue to work together, you lead to the possibilities of eruptions. If we had decided 70 years ago there will be two states within the state, then things would be easy. We wouldn't be fighting. We keep fighting because leaders like Ben-Gurion and Rav Goren said it's worth being uncomfortable if it means we can build this state together, and that people who disagree vehemently can join together to build a shared future. And therefore, it may be disheartening, but there's also something heartening about it, that Rav Goren Ben-Gurion's vision won, that we're trying to stay together. It may not always work. We may sometimes fight, right? We may fight a lot. We may have to recalibrate. We may have to rethink. But it was in service of this vision of these great leaders, religious and secular, in the 40s and the 50s, who said, it's worth all the pain and stress and suffering and fighting if we manage to muddle through and create this dream, the state of Israel, without making two states, one for religious Jews and one for secular ones. And that's a vision worth fighting for and even being a little bit angry about sometimes. So when I explore Rav Goren's thought and his life, and his relationship with Ben-Gurion, and I study his life, I'm inspired by their conviction that the Jewish people are going through a momentous historical development, that we need to mark that symbolically so that we internalize the emotions, the pathos of the moment. I'm inspired by their conviction that we have to work together, even though it's going to make both of us angry and both of us uncomfortable. I'm inspired by their recognition that we have to be creative. We need to make concessions, because if we really want to create this Jewish state and work together, then something's got to give. And it gives me a little bit of hope that even as we fight and things heat up, as they always do perennially in Israel over these issues, the reason we're fighting is because we made that decision at that meeting in 1948 to not split and not say, you be comfortable, I'll be comfortable, you daven all day and eat cholent, and we'll do whatever we want. We made the decision to work together, knowing full well the tension it would cause, but saying, it's like our family, right? We don't kick out the family members that sometimes annoy us because we want the family to stick together, and we just swallow it, right? Israel is the same in many ways, because Ben-Gurion and Rav Goren and people like that said, yeah, we're family, we're going to have differences, we're going to have problems, but we're going to work through them, we're going to figure it out, and we're going to scream and yell while we're doing it, because that's what we do as Jews, but we're going to do it, and we're going to give, and we're going to be creative, and we're going to make it work. And that, I think, is something inspiring as we move forward. So that's a bit about Rav Goren's history. Like I said, it's worth reading his autobiography. It really is. It's a fascinating experience. Next week, Roy Turchiner, I don't remember who. Again, if you haven't signed in, the sign-in sheets are in the back.